Nature Fix is proudly sponsored by Craghoppers, one of the UK's favourite outdoor gear experts. Craghoppers and the National Trust have joined forces to create a collection inspired by nature and designed for life. Sales from the range help to support the National Trust's vital work, restoring some of our incredible natural landscapes, from delicate wetlands to boggy peatlands. Together, we are working to look after nature and care for our landscapes for generations to come. Hello and welcome to Nature Fix with me, Claire Hickenbotham. Every month we take you with us as we meet the people who spend their time outside and join them in a place that most inspires them. Today we're in West London, not far from busy Heathrow, to meet entomologist Connor Butler, who has a passion for flipping over rotten logs. And while he's used that passion to get thousands of people to notice nature, it's also one of the ways he introduces people to queer ecology. Connor, nice Hi. To meet you. Thank you for bringing me to Austerley. I can't quite believe how countrified it is when we are so surrounded by the capital city.
It's quite a shock when you walk from the tube station. It feels like you're walking into this little country village and then down these country lanes and you get this magnificent estate. It is strange to be in London and be surrounded by so much nature.
Shall we walk?
Let's go. I'm an entomologist, so that's someone who studies insects. And if I had to be more specific, I would say that my main interest is in beetles and those creatures that live in dead wood, rotting wood.
And tell me about the walk that we are going on today. We're specifically looking for queer ecology, is that right?
Yeah, so have you ever heard of this phrase before?
No, I haven't.
It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but to me, it's all about challenging the perceptions of what we consider to be natural or unnatural. And to give a bit of context as to why that's important, as a member of the LGBTQ+ community, historically, people in that community have been called unnatural. But actually, when you look at nature, it's so diverse, it's so fluid, it doesn't follow so many of the binaries that we think it does. And so queer ecology is all about challenging those expectations and seeing actually what is nature really all about. Let's go look at some big trees. There are some huge trees here. Can we look at this tree for a second, actually? So this tree is a yew tree, a European yew. And you can identify them because often their bark is kind of a bit scaly, very flaky, I would say. If you imagine a flake chocolate bar, but in tree form.
It's exactly like that, isn't it?
Right. And then their leaves are kind of a bit sort of coniferous, so very small needle.
A bit Christmas tree, aren't they?
Yeah, giving a bit of Christmas tree. It's a very interesting tree. They're some of the longest living trees in the UK. They think that, well, there's a few contenders for the oldest tree in the UK, but one of them is a yew tree up in Scotland called the Fortingall yew, and they think it could be over 3,000 years old, which is pretty impressive. Now, how this links to queer ecology is because often what we think about nature is that there are two sexes. Actually, only about 5% of plants have separate sexes. The majority of them don't. They can do everything. Produce seeds and produce pollen. A yew tree has separate sexes, and in the plant world that's called dioecious. So you get trees that produce pollen, which is kind of like the male equivalent, and then trees that produce seeds, which contain ovaries that produce the seeds. Now the oldest tree in the UK that I mentioned earlier is a male tree, it produces pollen. But about 10 years ago, they noticed right at the top of this tree, the yew tree had started producing seeds. And in yews, they're quite noticeable because they produce these really red fruits called arils. And it's made scientists realise that actually a lot of trees are quite fluid in their sexuality and they can transition between male or female.
I've got so many questions. Just like, why, after all those years? What's the process? What's happening there?
If I was to anthropomorphise for a second, if you are a pollen-producing tree, all you're doing is wafting your pollen into the wind. So you have no idea if you're producing any offspring. But if you can then turn partially seed producing, you could either self-pollinate or get pollen from somewhere else and know that you're producing some seeds to carry your offspring and your genetics into the future. So I guess it's an evolutionary advantage to be fluid in some ways.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, whether or not it's an intentional thing or it's just as it gets older, it gets a bit fluid. Or perhaps it was always fluid. We've just never really noticed it, I guess, because we always assume that things are set in stone, whereas actually maybe the default is that everything is a bit more fluid.
That's amazing. It's a really good point to ask you a few questions, actually, about as we... Well, should we keep walking?
Let's go for a little wander, yeah.
I know you're really keen to get into the meadow and look at some cow dung, I think. Maybe we'll end up there. You lead walks, don't you? You're known as the queer ecologist, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And you take people on queer ecology walks. When you're able to show people the yew tree, how do you find people react to that?
I think it's generally positive, and I think the outcome is always that there's so much about nature we don't know, or maybe so much about nature that we presume, and actually it's so diverse. There's no one rule that fits everything. Everything is different. And that's kind of always the take home that I want to get, that this idea that something is can be natural or unnatural is ridiculous. It's a very socially implied term and it has no basis in nature. And people can take what they will from that about themselves. I like to think that it means that we are all part of nature, and as a queer person, I'm as natural as anyone else is natural, because we are part of nature, I guess, and that's hopefully the point. And also, the great thing about my walks is that you get a load of people who maybe have been marginalised by society that can come together in a positive space, connect with nature, make friends. So it's a really great community building opportunity as well.
And do you feel people go away feeling more at peace with themselves?
I hope so. I think hopefully we'll also look at nature in a different light as well, because as much as I'm trying to, you know, change the idea of what's natural or unnatural, I'm also trying to change people's perspectives about what nature is, because often a lot of the walks I do are not in beautiful grounds like this. They're in urban parks, they're in really kind of, you know, concrete spaces, and it's always easy to find lots of nature in really urban spaces if you change what nature is. So as an entomologist, I spend a lot of my time looking at really, really tiny things that most people would overlook. But actually, if you've got a hand lens out, like a magnifying lens, you're on your hands and knees looking at mosses and tiny little ants. There's nature everywhere. It's all just about perspective.
So I'm imagining your audience for that might be somebody who does the same commute or the same school run every day and is busy with their thoughts doing something else. And then they come on one of your walks and they've sped past all these things for days and years on end, and now they're noticing more and slowing down a bit, and that has an impact as well, doesn't it?
I think it does. I think especially something that I noticed during COVID, when we were sort of confined to our houses, we could go for our daily walk, and I was walking the same route every day because it was the only excuse to get outside. And I found that I really started to notice all the changing of the seasons. I started to notice and appreciate all the weeds that were growing through the cracks of the alleyways. Again, my definition of nature massively changed because I was spending time to just observe. And I think that's a really powerful thing. It's really good for your mental health to just sort of observe tiny things and slow down. And also being able to identify plants and animals is really something that we should all do, because it means that you take more notice. And being able to walk past a yew tree and say, oh, that's a yew tree, and then everywhere you go you see yew trees and you can identify it, and it's such a nice feeling in my brain to be able to know what something is and give it a name. Noticing it is important, and just take a photo of it on our phone. So there's so many apps out there that can detect and identify bird song, plants, just by, you know, sound or photos. So we live in this amazing world where we can identify things so much easier than we could before, and we should really make the most of it, because I think the more we notice, the more we can learn to identify, the more interesting thing there is to see.
So have you always been into nature?
Yeah, for most of my life I think I have. I grew up in Oxfordshire, which is quite a green place to go up. And my mum would always take me to Oxford Natural History Museum. If you haven't been, have you been to Oxford?
Well, I was going to just say, we should take a moment to appreciate Oxford Natural History Museum, because if you say Natural History Museum, you think of the one in London, don't you? But the one in Oxford, I think I must have been to about 20 times. It's the most fantastic space and place, isn't it?
It's much smaller than London, but I think it's a bit quainter. It has these amazing ceilings, this amazing collection of mammal skeletons on one side, but dinosaurs on the other side, and then all around it lots of pinned insects. It's an incredible space. Going there as a kid, I just became hooked on nature, and then my dad would always take me out to forage mushrooms, and thankfully survived. he was good with his identification. Maybe we'll go on this way. This is quite nice.
What is it that you've seen down here that you
I
like?
I can just see some stumps, and I cannot pass a good stump without having a little look. So it looks like they're made to nice little tree stumps that you could easily sit on. But also, if you were to flip these over, I reckon we'll find some good things. Right, should we give this one a flip towards us? Okay. We've definitely got some slug trails.
What's this here on the base?
This is a centipede. You find a little pot.
Do you carry these tubes with you wherever you go?
Always got to carry bug pots wherever you go. So this here is a centipede, and they're predators of snails, mostly active at night, actually.
So that's why he likes it under the tree stump, because it's dark.
It's dark, and there's lots of prey under there. So this is a good comparison. So in the UK, we have centipedes and we have millipedes. This one is a millipede. Any ideas how to tell the difference between a centipede and a millipede?
It's got something to do with the numbers of legs, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So centipedes don't have 100, millipedes don't have 1,000. But basically the body of these invertebrates is broken up into loads of different segments. Sometimes it can be 20, 30. There is some centipedes with nearly 100 segments, actually. But it's to do with the number of legs per segment. So millipedes have got 4 legs per segment, and centipedes have got 2 legs per segment. And that's how you tell the difference.
Why does something need so many legs?
That's one of life's big questions. Why does it have so many legs? Yeah. Because at what point does it get too many legs? Because there are some centipedes that have 100 legs. I think it's interesting because if I shoehorn it back to queer ecology, often you see lots of invertebrates. Sometimes you see beetles mating with other male beetles. And people say, well, why does it do that? It doesn't make evolutionary sense. And that's kind of some of the problem with the way we think about the world, is that everything has to have a purpose. Why does it do that? Why does it do that? And we never know. It's just evolved that way. That's just how it is. And that's okay. And we can just leave it there. Who knows why it has so many legs?
As a scientist, you have to be then comfortable with some things don't have an answer.
Yeah, well, I guess we're trying to, again, put things a little bit in human perspective. We're very biased in the reasons we think some things exist. Right, should we flip this log back over?
Do we want to pop him back as well?
Yeah, do you want to undo the pot?
Off he goes.
Should we do one more?
Let's do another one.
All right, let's lift up this one. It's quite a big log, this one.
Oh, there's lots under
here. Oh, that's nice. Oh, this is nice as well. So this, let me just get it in my pot. This is a woodlouse. This actually has 14 legs. So woodlice are crustaceans, so related to crabs and lobsters.
Are they really?
Yeah, yeah. Which is why you often find them dead and dried up in your houses, because they're not actually very good at being on land.
So I grew up in a very, very old house, and we had these everywhere, all of the time, dead. But they have another name. So I always used to know them as woodlouse, but friends refer to them as woodpigs.
Woodlice have got the most colloquial names of any animal in the UK. I think there's like over 100 different names for woodlice. In theory, depending on your word for woodlouse, you can tell which region in the UK you're from.
So it's the same as what you might call a bread roll, and you'd recognise somebody from it being a cob or a bun.
Exactly.
It's the same with woodlouse.
So sometimes they're called pill bugs, they're roly-polies, they're chucky pigs, they're cheese logs.
So where do you think I come from then, if a friend of mine called it a woodpick?
Somewhere up north, maybe? Yorkshire-y way? I don't know.
Yeah. Lincolnshire.
What's interesting about woodlice is that it's actually really difficult to find male and female woodlice. So for some species, you can only ever find females. And it's really confusing, so they did some experiments, and they would watch a female woodlouse give birth, and she'd only give birth to female woodlice. So again, really confusing. They did some other studies where they gave a pregnant female woodlouse antibiotics, and when they did that, she started producing males and females. And it turns out that woodlice are infected by a bacteria called Wolbachia, and this bacteria can only be transferred through the eggs of female woodlice. If it's born into a male woodlouse, the bacteria will die when that male dies, and it can't be passed on. So it's in the bacteria's interest to be born into female woodlice. So this bacteria has then evolved some really amazing mechanisms to kind of get its way. And one of the ways it does that is that it changes the hormones of developing male woodlice and turns them functionally female and able to lay eggs. Yeah. So this woodlice could be genetically male, but able to lay eggs and reproduce. So it's a complicated one. I like to think of it that these woodlice have gotten sick with this bacteria and then overthrown the woodlice patriarchy. So the other interesting thing is that if there's only females, how are they going to reproduce, right? So in some species, this bacteria goes this extra step and can give woodlice the ability to reproduce asexually and clone themselves. It's wild.
So woodlouse is one of the most incredible things on the planet, really.
And so common in all of our houses, and yet we know so little about their life cycle. And yet this is, you know, arguably perfectly natural, perfectly normal for a woodlouse.
Wow. Shall we pop him back?
Let's pop him back. You've always got to put the log back because they need that dampness and that moisture underneath to survive. Should we go walk in a meadow, perhaps? There's a nice...
Yes.
Oh, let's go over here. Firstly, well, I'm seeing some poo on the ground. This is the poo of a rabbit. And what's interesting to me is that there are some dung beetles that feed on rabbit dung. And there's one called a minotaur beetle. And these are quite big black beetles. They're about the size of your thumb, fingernail maybe. And they take these balls of rabbit dung and bury them. So if you imagine rabbits are eating leaves, stuff like that, they're then pooing out. The beetles are kind of eating those leaves a second time around. There's still nutrients in it. And that's why actually rabbits often eat their own droppings sometimes, if you've got a pet rabbit. So they're just eating, yeah, the food a second time around.
So a dung beetle wouldn't eat grass?
No, but it would eat grass that's been partially digested by a
prepared
horse or a cow.
By a rabbit.
That's it, exactly, yeah.
So the rabbit is the chef of the natural world.
That's a very interesting way of thinking about dung beetles. Mind the nettles.
So you've talked about how much you love nature and where you think that love came from. When did you realise that it was specifically bugs?
I used to have a huge fear of spiders, and to some degree, still do a little bit. When I started volunteering in a natural history museum in Hampshire, the first day I went there, they put this drawer of insects in front of me, and they needed volunteers to basically type up the data that was on the labels of these pinned insects. Some of them are hundreds of years old. And the first ever drawer of insects they put in front of me was this drawer of stag beetles. Have you ever seen a stag beetle?
They're quite big, aren't they? And have got quite menacing-looking claws on them almost.
Yeah, they're almost like antlers almost, where the name stag comes from, like a deer antler. So it was those beetles that were put in front of me. And it was something about seeing these massive beetles so up close that just made me fall in love with them. Because normally when we see insects, it's in our houses, it feels like this infestation, it gives a real kind of negative response from us. I think it's very innate in our biology, the fact that we kind of are very squeamish about insects in our houses because we associate them with dirtiness. And so seeing these insects up close just totally changed my perspective because they're so ornate, they're so beautiful, they've got these amazing colours, these amazing structures. It just totally flipped my brain on them. I no longer felt that kind of disgust, and somehow I was just so enamoured by them. And they're really beautiful when you look at them up close. And then since then, I've been hooked.
I love the fact that you've got so many stories for all these tiny little things. That's what makes it fascinating, isn't it? There's so much more to them than meets the eye.
Yeah, I think that's it. They're so overlooked. I've always had this thing for the underdog of the natural world. The things that are considered gross, like the dung beetles, the stuff that lives under rotting wood. It's all slimy and it's all dark. And yet they're so fascinating. I think there's something that, I don't know, maybe I'd identify with, that kind of being overlooked or the underdog. That's what kind of holds my interest in insects, because they are so overlooked yet so important for everything. All of our food, all of our farming, everything is dependent upon insects.
So the walks, they're queer ecology walks, and I now understand that there's kind of a double meaning to that.
Yeah.
So one thing I just want to kind of clear up is, can anyone come on these walks?
For a while, my walks were called The Birds and the Bees. And I once had this married couple, a man and a woman, came on my walk, and they didn't realise that it was a queer ecology walk until I gave this, you know, introduction to kind of set the scene. And they came up to me and they said, oh, we didn't realise this was a queer walk. Can we still come? And I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's for everyone. Standing at the back of the group, they didn't want to get too involved. But they came up to the end and said they really, really enjoyed it. And actually now I've seen them probably two or three times. They come on lots of my other walks, so it kind of proved the point that it is for everyone. It's just a nature walk. It's just about appreciating nature and all of its diversity. Nature is for everyone, and some people need a little bit of a guide to tell them how to engage with nature. The fact that you can turn over a log and be really amazed at all the little tiny creatures that live underneath it, because most people will pass those logs and not have a second look. But hopefully you're now going to be in the log club and you're going to be lifting over logs.
I feel like you've changed me in the hour that we've walked, because the first thing I noticed was the deck chairs and I wanted to sit down and read my book. Now I want to flip over a log and find the amazing woodlouse.
If you roll over a log, you'll find all the woodlice, all the millipedes, sometimes beetles. It is the gift that keeps on giving.
There's a lot of joy in rotting logs.
That's it. I could honestly spend hours and hours head down looking at rotting wood. It is my favourite thing in the world.
Thanks for listening to Nature Fix. We'll be back next month with a new episode. Why not give us a follow on your favourite podcast app? And if you've got the time, leave us a review. Bye for now. Nature Fix is proudly sponsored by outdoor gear experts Craghoppers. Heading out for adventure? Discover Craghoppers' National Trust range of clothing and accessories. Inspired by nature and designed to last, each item in the collection comes with a guarantee for life. And with every purchase, you're helping to support the Trust's vital work restoring our natural landscapes. Get ready for your journey outdoors at craghoppers.com/national-trust.